The Sandstone Foundation presents Sex and the Divine Image, recorded live at the 1985 Sandstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
It's 11 o'clock and time for us to start. We have a lot of information to cover, so I think if we get started on time, that will allot some time at the end for questions. I'd like to welcome all of you to this session. It is Sex and the Divine Image, and we have a full house, which we expected to have. Our speakers today are Paul James Toscano. Paul will be addressing in his paper, The Marriage of God. Paul is the Associate General Counsel of Consolidated CFS, is that the way we, CFS Financial Corporation. He has a BA, an MA, and a JD from Brigham Young University. He's published numerous articles, including Gospel Letters to a Mormon Missionary, Tragedy and Redemption, which was published in BYU Studies. He's published in The Ensign, The New Era. And last year he was, a participant in the conference speaking on Is God Married? And I think this is probably a follow-up to that. Our second paper will be presented by Margaret Merrill Toscano. Margaret is speaking on mythology, sexuality, and role reversals. Margaret is a part-time instructor in Greek and Latin at Brigham Young University, which she has done for 10 years. She has prepared a paper on the missing rib, which will be published soon in Sunstone. She has her BA and her MA from Brigham Young University, and she and Paul are the parents of four daughters. The comments today on these two papers will be given by Annette Sorensen Rogers. Annette is a professional writer. She's currently preparing a book for publication. She has received the Sigma Delta Chi Award for her article on the unspeakable crime. She's the former managing editor of Utah Holiday. She has been the staff assistant to Western Savings and a programming officer for Bankers Trust in New York. Annette has her bachelor's degree and her master's in history from the University of Utah. And we're glad to have the three of them here with us today. We expect this to be one of the highlights of the conference. In order to get through the material and give all of you a chance to, if you'd like to, ask some questions, we're going to limit the speakers to a time. We're going to ask Paul and Margaret to both limit themselves to 25 minutes and not a minute more. And we will ask Annette to limit her comments to 20 minutes. And I don't have a bell, but you and I can all let them know when their time is up. And if they do run over, I will mention it to them so that we can move on, giving all of you a chance also to make some comments at the end, and that will make it possible. So we'll turn the time over to Paul. Here we go.
I didn't realize we'd be placed under such severe time constraints. I don't know what will happen if I can't reach the end of my paper. Whenever I hear that somebody announced me that I have had all my degrees at BYU, I wish to correct an impression of by being parochial by telling you that I have traveled widely. In Orem. Years ago, an ad appeared for a Hitchcock thriller. It said that no one would be admitted to the theater once the movie had begun. Hitchcock didn't want anyone to miss the opening scenes because they were the key to the rest of the show. Margaret and I feel the same way about this introduction. The next few minutes of my talk, which is going to be delivered very rapidly, contains the key of our presentation. Though Margaret and I both love history and admire very much the work of Mormon historians, particularly that produced in the last 20 years, we are not ourselves historians, and the approach we will take today is not an historical one. Rather, we are interested in Mormon theology, ritual, symbolism, and myth. Our papers today reflect that, for they are theological and not historical in orientation. Mormon historians have held center stage in our intellectual community for over a decade, and their influence is so strong that any paper that does not treat Mormonism from an historical and empirical perspective runs the risk of receiving a second-class welcome, and for this reason, an explanation of our approach seems warranted before we address the substance of our remarks. History is essentially a story. But good history is more than mere narrative. It must be scientific to a considerable extent. It must rest upon real evidence, documents, and artifacts. People, places, dates, things, and ideas must have actually unfolded in time in identifiable, demonstrable, and verifiable ways. History relies upon this type of evidence to tie events to particular sectors within a known chronological framework. For this reason, people see history as highly reliable. For most people, history represents the truth about how the present came to be. History, however, is not the past. Rather, it is a partial recounting of selected pieces of the past. It is composed of incidents whose causes and effects the historian wishes to understand and illuminate. Most past incidents are disregarded because they illuminate and explain nothing. A baby is born, a volcano erupts, a cow moves in its stall. But some of these incidents may seem to be important to our story. These are not simply occurrences, they are events. Not a baby, but Elizabeth I is born. Not a volcano, but Mount Vesuvius erupts. Not a cow, but Mrs. O'Leary's cow moves in its stall. Besides being empirical and selective, history is also sequential. An historical narrative is created by what the ancient Greeks called the systasis ton pragmaton, the arrangement of the material. The primary arrangement of historical materials is that of cause and effect. Facts are seen as causes which lead to effects, which in turn become causes that themselves lead to other effects, and so on. The problem with causation, of course, is the proper interpretation of what causes gave rise to what effects. This is particularly difficult in the context of religious history, where historical events are claimed to have been to proceed from supernatural causes that lie beyond the scope of the ordinary empirical historical approach. Joseph Smith visits the Shakers and later writes a revelation on economic communalism. What caused the revelation? The visit to the Shakers? God? Some third unknown cause? The internal creativity of Joseph Smith? Some of the above? All of the above? The more committed to empiricism an historian is, the more likely he or she will be to dismiss the supernatural as the cause of the historical events. The willingness to seriously admit, and I have to read my marginal notes, and it's very hard, to seriously admit the supernatural into the historical analysis is, I believe, what distinguishes faithful from secular history, and neither of which need necessarily be confused with simply whitewashed history, which is an attempt to support a particular current party line. It is perhaps difficult to say, in the example I gave of Joseph Smith's visit to the Shakers, of what caused the revelations. My point, however, is that the call of causation is present in an historian's analysis, and it is very strong. This characteristic of causation is the dominant feature in history, because it allows the historian to understand what events influenced later people to say and do what they said and did. It is this feature that gives history its essentially linear shape. When most people think of history, I believe they imagine a continuum stretching from the present into the past. The more sophisticated a person's historical sense, the more this image becomes cluttered with parallel lines, byways, loops, detours, and signposts. This linear paradigm is very popular and very satisfying. Margaret and I rely on this framework and appreciate those who employ it well. But we also see equal value in the mythical, symbolic, ritualistic, and theological approach to understanding the past, the present, and even the future. This mythic approach does not deny the truth and value of the historical. It merely superimposes upon it another paradigm. If the historical paradigm can be represented by a horizontal continuum, then the theological paradigm may best be represented by a vertical line intersecting it. The mythic approach is primarily concerned not with cause and effect, but with microcosms and archetypes, by which known realities, besides being historically true, become symbols through which the mind, usually the intuitive part of the mind, may grasp as yet unknown realities. Thus, the event of Moses leading the people of Israel through the wilderness, through the waters of the Red Sea, and eventually into the Promised Land, not only serves as a story in the historical sense, but as a symbol of the journey of the soul through the wilderness of sin into the waters of regeneration and out again into the abundant grace of God. This approach is not altogether unfamiliar to us. We see it employed to deny the actuality of supernatural events, while stressing their significance as charming antique legends that represent some theological or ethical proposition. Thus, the miracles of the Bible, the universal flood, the Tower of Babel, the feeding of the 5,000 are seen as allegories. However, what is less popular and less respectable is any attempt to acknowledge the symbolic significance of the supernatural, while simultaneously continuing to assert its historical reality. Most would acknowledge, for example, the Garden of Eden as a symbol. Many fewer would acknowledge it as an historical reality, but I suspect that fewer still are those who would acknowledge it as both. Equally unpopular is the approach that sees known historical realities as representations of ahistorical realities. What is he talking about? That is, to see everyday events and occurrences as microcosms of the macrocosm, as containing the pattern of some greater or more significant reality. This is exactly what occurs in religious ritual. The ordinary breaking of bread becomes the symbol of the broken flesh of the dying God. The cup of wine or water becomes the God's blood, shed for the regeneration of mankind. The washing of feet, an ordinary hospitality ritual in some ancient cultures, becomes the symbol of the imputation of the God's righteousness to the sinful individual. Religious ordinances represent the clearest and most familiar example of the transformation of ordinary occurrences into sacred events and of seeing in the imminent the image of the divine. In short, history and myth are at cross purposes, for the purpose of history is to help us understand the causes that shape the present. The purpose of myth is to help us understand the meaning of the present and its relation to the past, to the future, and to the divine. For the historian, life is quintessentially a chronicle. For the theologian, it is quintessentially a symbol. Although Margaret and I see history as a valuable technique for ascertaining the truth of our story, it is not the only technique available to us. Equally valuable, though admittedly less objective and empirical, is the technique of seeing facts not merely as a narrative but as a poem full of symbols that must be pondered and interpreted in order to arrive at a knowledge of the existence and meaning of complex truths. In our opinion, historians must continue to tell us the story of what happened and how that affected what happened to those who came later. But by the same token, theologians and mystics should be respected for their attempt to see as events as parables and to extract from them the meaning of realities that cannot be seen directly. I am sure that some of you who are deeply committed to the empirical historical approach will find what we have to say reminiscent of the work of soothsayers studying the entrails of birds to augur the intentions of the gods. But we think there is considerable intellectual rigor in the theory that the universe is both holistic and hologrammic, that the pattern of the eternal is in the temporal, that the structure of the whole is to be found reflected in the patterns displayed in the parts. I say all this by way of introduction because a knowledge of the divine marriage is not evidenced historically or empirically. It is arrived at by the kind of symbolic and theological analysis I have been talking about. Therefore, it will always remain a theological proposition that can never enjoy the status of a known and objectively demonstrable and verifiable fact. But this is not to say there is no evidence for the proposition, only that it falls short of the kind of objective proof we are used to. Nevertheless, symbolic and mythic evidence for the notion may, for those who do not have a fetish for objectivity, prove to be illuminating and even energy liberating. The marriage of the Heavenly Father and the Heavenly Mother, as I perceive it, is not to be mistaken for the bourgeois affair so prominently depicted in our church manuals and so well stereotyped in the 1950s sitcom Father Knows Best. You remember Dad, Mom, Princess, Bud, and Little Kitten. The divine marriage is a sexual, spiritual, and mystical union between two personalities who are united as the eternal one. Through this divine union, the male and the female epicenters of the universe are joined into a living, creative, and redemptive center, the eternal God, the Father and Mother of heaven and earth. Seen in this way, the proposition that God is married is not a trivial one, for it goes to the heart of the theological question regarding God's nature, transcendence, infinitude, and supremacy. The proposition God is married presupposes that God exists, is not totally other, and is in part knowable. It presupposes that God is the union of at least two anthropomorphic and sexual persons, male and female, of equal stature, who enjoy complete union on many levels, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, and mystical. To Christians who believe it, this proposition implies that Jesus Christ is the issue of the eternal Father and Mother, and that Christ's ministry on earth as a sexual, anthropomorphic, and married individual was a revelation of the nature of God. This unorthodox position usually constitutes an affront to mainline Christianity, which insists that God is and can only be totally other, a concept that results from the orthodox Christian confusion of the holy with the ideal. Holiness is a concept arrived at through a mortal's direct contact with God. Holiness is the human description of God's projection of himself into the fallen world. Idealism is a concept arrived at not through experience with the divine, but through a process of pure reason, whereby an individual projects an image of God that is stripped of any materiality, specificity, locality, temporality, or change. The holy God is God as he reveals himself to be. The ideal God is the revelation of human reason. The God revealed by Joseph Smith, particularly in the latter part of his life, is not an ideal God. Joseph depicts him as an anthropomorphic individual whose divine attributes are often merely human attributes in perfect form. Perhaps what makes Joseph Smith's views of God so unpalatable to some is the notion that God possesses in perfection the very same characteristics that have caused mortals so much shame, consternation, and confusion: our bodies, our sexuality, our specificity, our being, all of which lie beyond our complete understanding and our complete control. Perhaps those who reject these attributes as they are perfected in God do so because they despise them as they appear in their imperfect form in themselves. Traditionally, idealistic Christianity has rejected such anthropomorphic characteristics as theologically absurd, and the residue of this process of denial is not the holy God, but an ideal one. In propounding the ideal God, idealism must deny the literalness or central message of all those scriptures, parables, and symbols that suggest that God is an individual, anthropomorphic, and sexual being. Moreover, idealism also insists upon a false and pathological dualism between the spirit and the body, the material and the immaterial, the immanent and the transcendent, the natural and the supernatural. It also creates an unacceptable dualism between the male and the female, wherein spirituality is connected with maleness and earthliness is connected with femaleness. The result of this view is God the Father without God the Mother. It should be easy to see how such a view could lead to the relegation of the female to a status of inferiority and undesirability, a sex object to be exploited and then hated, or an object to be put on a pedestal and neutralized. Much of the oppression which Western woman has suffered may be traceable, I believe, to ideal dualism, which puts God beyond maleness and femaleness, beyond personhood, and therefore beyond reach. The idealistic fallacy was borrowed by the primitive church from the late 5th century Greeks. It was not, however, in all fairness to them, the most ancient religion of Greece. Much earlier, the Greeks believed in a pantheon of sexual anthropomorphic deities. As philosophy came into prominence, this more ancient religion faded. This is also true of Judaism, where Yahweh was first presented as an anthropomorphic and sexual deity, only to be obscured by Jewish philosophers and rabbis. It is not surprising, then, that Christ, who was first understood to be an anthropomorphic sexual person both before and after the resurrection, was also idealized. The holy Christ so offended common sense, philosophical wisdom, the deeply rooted sense of bodily shame, and the lofty pretensions of the intellect and reason that the early church fathers were virtually compelled to depersonify, disembody, and castrate him. Time marched on. Idealism flowered and then started to lose its grip on the souls of Europe. People began slipping into polytheism via the worship of saints and angels. Magic appeared in the worship of relics. Sexuality reemerged in the person of Mary the Virgin. Mysticism began gaining ascendancy. The Protestant Reformation was the conservative Orthodox reaction to this slippage. It was a reaffirmation of the grip on Christendom of idealistic dualism, with all of its neuroses of shame and guilt, with its anti-polytheistic Trinitarianism, its psychotic debasement of women, its deification of Scripture, its depersonalization of God, and its refusal to see God as anything but philosophically ideal. Protestantism, remember, is the Christianity of the Enlightenment. It is intolerant of the mystical and arrogantly certain of the reasonable. It has historically disfavored ritual and prefers the humanistic elements of religion, the Bible, authentic texts, linguistic scholarship, rational and philosophical answers to religious questions, and allegiance to creeds. Even conversion is usually predicated upon literacy and one's ability to rightly understand Holy Writ. And the Protestant rejection of the papacy was not a rejection of the Pope's temporal authority, which was often claimed by the reformers for themselves or their political supporters, but a rejection of the Pope's claim to spiritual and mystical authority. This the Protestants replaced with the far more controllable and reasonable authority of manageable scriptural texts. Mormonism serves as an antidote both to the Greek idealism of Catholicism and to the Enlightenment idealism of the Protestant Reformation. I recently spoke to some friends who left the church. They did this because they could not accept a God or a religion that was not ideal. They couched this position in an accusation against Joseph Smith. They claimed that his biggest mistakes were his advocacy of anthropomorphism, polytheism, and his involvement in polygamy and magic. I disagree with my friends and believe instead that among Joseph Smith's greatest contributions to Christianity were his teachings on anthropomorphism, polytheism, sexuality, and magic. The evidence in the Bible for an anthropomorphic deity is considerable, but is usually dismissed by Orthodox Christianity as a result of scriptural interpretations that are crude or naive. This, of course, is not argument, it is name-calling. Unless one can conclusively demonstrate that God truly does not have a body of flesh and bones as tangible as man's, there is nothing inherently inferior in the belief that God is anthropomorphic. This view of God is suggested by such passages as those that tell us that Yahweh walked in Eden with Adam and Eve, that he sat with Abraham in the plains of Mamre, that he put Moses in the cleft of a rock and showed him his back parts. The Bible further suggests that God has passions, anger and jealousy, love and mercy. He is a God who mourns when his children sin and can even be entreated to change his mind. God calls Israel his children, and Jesus tells his disciples to address God as Father in heaven, and to love him with all their hearts, souls, and minds. In light of these depictions, an anthropomorphic view of God, if not inevitable or reasonable, is at least understandable. As for polytheism, it is itself suggested by the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," which allows for the existence of other gods, but insists upon the sovereignty of the one. The strict monotheism, which is said to be the greatest contribution of Judaism, is not wholly supported by the ancient texts of the Jews themselves, which refer to the Elohim, the gods, which suggest the anthropomorphism and sexuality of Yahweh, and which treat seriously the existence of angel spirits and weak local divinities. Besides, strict monotheism is repugnant to Jesus' revelation of three gods, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. His reaffirmation of the existence of angels, devils, and spirits, and according to John the Revelator, the existence of a host of other supernatural beings. As for sexuality, Orthodox Christianity teaches that we can approach God only to the degree we repudiate our sexuality, especially if one is a woman. This is a highly damaging assertion that I suspect is at the root of much of our modern sexual schizophrenia. Joseph Smith, on the other hand, taught that sexuality and marriage are means by which God is approached. Salvation involves the justification, sanctification, resurrection, and glorification of the individual sexual person. Ultimately, Christian union involves economic, social, political, spiritual, as well as sexual union. Sex is not a mistake. It should not be a source of shame. It is an attribute of God. And last of all, there is magic, what some consider as Mormonism's dirty little secret, but which, in my view, is neither secret nor necessarily dirty. The Book of Mormon speaks candidly about its own coming forth, out of the ground, with a voice as one that hath a familiar spirit. The term familiar does not mean recognizable, but refers instead to a demon that is supposed to be in association with or under the power of a human being, something of a domesticated imp that guards treasures and does the bidding of the magician that conjures it. The scriptures in general are rather unabashed in their reference to magic as being peripherally linked to Judaism or Christianity. Moses' staff, Aaron's strange garb, the Urim and Thummim, the rhapsodic trances of members of the later prophetic schools, Joseph's cup of divination, the witch of Endor's successful conjuring of the spirit of the prophet Samuel, the competitive exhibition conducted between Elijah and the priests of Baal, the strange method Elijah employed to raise from the dead the widow's son. As for Joseph's white salamander in the stone box, animals have often been present, perhaps as mediums of divine intervention at many important religious junctures. A sacrificial lamb was present at the time the plan of redemption was first revealed to Adam and Eve. A ram was present at the arrested sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham. Moses' serpent swallows up the serpents of the magician priests of Pharaoh. White goats and sheep and unblemished bullocks form part of Judaic ritual. There were the swine into which Jesus cast the evil spirits, and of course at the baptism of Christ himself there appeared a white dove. There is no time here to further ramify the possible significance of all this. My purpose is merely to observe that there is evidence in the scriptures themselves of a link between Judaism, Christianity, and magic, and this link is not at all a secret to those who know anything about magic. Finally, magic need not necessarily be dirty. In the Middle Ages, there were many devout Christians who viewed white magic in the same way we of the 20th century view science, as yet another means of discovering the secrets of the universe. Moreover, magic is related to all religions that emphasize holiness rather than intellectual idealism. Magic is a form of ritual. Ritual is the sacralization of life, the attempt to connect the natural with the supernatural, to find God in the ordinary occurrences of life and in them and in him to find divine meaning. Ritual is mythology in motion. Ritual and myth are essential mechanisms of spiritual communion in nearly all religions except the most idealized. Magic and ritual do have a dark side, but the evangelists testified in their accounts of Jesus, the miracle worker, that there may be a right place for this in Christianity. I say all this to underscore the fact that religion, the religion revealed by Joseph Smith, rejects the concept of idealism and posits instead the reality of the holy. Within such a tradition, the teaching that God is the divine union of the perfect and supreme male and the perfect and supreme female is not at all anomalous. But the question remains whether there is any evidence of a female goddess, a god the mother within the Judeo-Christian tradition. How much time do I have? I feel like I'm worn out.
You're going to quite a clip. Do you want a drink?
No, I just want to know the time. 10 minutes? Oh, another 10 minutes reprieve. You see, salvation by grace. Okay, the most obvious evidence is found in Genesis, which implies that when God's image is projected into the world, it manifests itself as both masculine and feminine. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. Though this verse is extremely powerful, it is admittedly isolated. Less familiar is the evidence of the Old Testament depiction of God's spirit and attributes as feminine figures. In particular, wisdom, Sophia, Chokhmah, takes on the aspect of a separate feminine deity who has a life of her own, almost apart from God. She is not merely a personification or a hypostasis, but a goddess in her own right. Sophia was with God before the foundations of the world, as she herself states in Proverbs, and I quote, "The Lord possessed me in the beginning of his way, before his works of old. I was set up from everlasting, from the beginning, or ever the earth was. When he appointed the foundations of the earth, then I was by him, as one brought up with him, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him." So Sophia herself addresses mankind in the authoritative manner of a divine being. She gives commandments to Israel in the same way God does and addresses Israel as her children. "Now therefore, hearken unto me, O ye children, for blessed are they that keep my ways. For whoso findeth me findeth life, and shall obtain favor of the Lord." So important does Sophia become in Jewish thought that Philo can state that God is the husband of Sophia. In late Talmudic literature, Sophia's function is taken over by the Shekinah, who began as God's presence personified, but eventually became the equal of a female divinity. Another evidence of God's female counterpart comes in the form of the cherubic figures on the Ark of the Covenant. These images not only appear to violate the second of the Ten Commandments, they appear to violate the first as well, for they reveal an early polytheistic element in Judaism. Raphael Patai conjectures that in the earliest stages of Israel's history, these two images, or slabs of stone contained in the ark, represented Yahweh and his consort. Later, these figures were reinterpreted as female guardians. Still later, after the destruction of the first temple, the idea gradually developed that God's nature contained two aspects, male and female, represented by these cherubim in the Holy of Holies of the second temple. In Talmudic times, the male cherub was considered as a symbol of God, while the female cherub, held and embraced by him, was commonly was the community of Israel personified. These feminine aspects of the divine reemerged in medieval Judaism in the mystical tradition of Kabbalism. Though the Zohar, the most important work of the movement, was written in the 13th century by Moses de Leon, he attributed to a 2nd century Palestinian mystic. In the Kabbalah, the four Hebrew letters of God's name, the YHWH, Yahweh, called the Tetragrammaton, are seen as the four divine elements which comprise the Hebrew God, a father, mother, son, and daughter, who stand for perfection and make up a divine tetrad. In the Zohar, we read that the letter Y, I'm not going to do the Hebrew, the letter Y in the name Yahweh is called Father and stands for wisdom. The first H is the supernal mother, called understanding. And the W and the second H are the two children, a son and daughter, who were crowned by their mother and are identified with beauty. The male is identified with beauty, and the female is identified with kingship because she crowns the king. The father and mother in this divine tetrad are so closely united and have such unceasing love that they give the impression of one body, androgynous in nature. The son and the daughter also become united as husband and wife and are known as king and matronet. However, the union of the younger pair does not have the stability of the union of the parents and is marked by quarrels, temporary separations, and tempestuous reunions, so that the pair was properly referred to as lovers. One reason for this troubled relationship was the matronet's identification with Israel, who frequently sinned, creating a rift with her husband, the king. Wayward Israel and her husband put in mind the bridegroom Christ wooing his bride, the church. And this comment brings me to our strongest evidence. Jesus Christ, as the incarnation of God, constitutes God's revelation to us of the divine nature. Through God the Son, we learn of God the Father. Jesus said, "He that hath seen me hath seen the Father." In Jesus, we see a God who is personal, anthropomorphic, sexual, and in part knowable. Moreover, when Jesus took a mortal wife, he both emulated and revealed the divine marriage of his heavenly Father and heavenly Mother. The marriage of Jesus is usually denied by Orthodox Christianity, but there is evidence for it set forth in a book entitled, Was Jesus Married? Not by Ogden Kraut, but by William E. Phipps, who gives the following arguments, a Protestant. First, given the Jewish view of marriage as a positive good and a gift from God, it is logical that Jesus would marry. It is a requirement for a rabbi, and therefore it is highly unlikely that Jesus would have been allowed to preach in the synagogues had he not been married. Certainly the Pharisees would have questioned him on this point, but they did not. Second point of Phipps, Jesus' treatment of women generally is more direct and open than the customs of his time allowed. There is Jesus' close relationship with certain New Testament women, such as Mary Magdalene, the first resurrection witness. Add to that his close relationship with Mary and Martha, evidenced by his involvement in their domestic and household affairs, a fact stressed by early Mormon leaders to support their teaching that Jesus practiced polygamy, a point which Phipps rejects. Third, there is Phipps' argument that the metaphor of Jesus as bridegroom and the church as bride supports the view that Christ was actually married. This marriage, in our view, validates earthly marriage while serving as an imitatio Dei. This evidence is neither conclusive nor exhaustive, but it is substantial enough to make the divine marriage of the father and mother and of the son and daughter plausible in contravention to the orthodox ideal view. Finally, though mainline Christianity may argue that to connect God with sexuality limits and confines him, we contend for the opposite proposition. The assertion that God cannot be anthropomorphic, sexual, and married is the limiting view. Why should God be relegated solely to the ethereal sphere? Isn't it more comprehensive to say that God is both spirit and matter? This is what Mormonism contends. It is sad that popular Mormonism sometimes overemphasizes the physical part of God's nature and thereby depicts him not as a heavenly but as an earthly father. But the Mormon scriptures do not do this. They affirm his personal anthropomorphic sexual nature while simultaneously affirming his majesty, sovereignty, and supremacy over the whole universe. Section 88 of the Doctrine and Covenants teaches that God comprehended all things, and all things are before him, and all things are round about him, and he is above all things and in all things, and is through all things, and is round about all things, and all things are by him and of him, even God, forever and ever. For us, God is holy and paradoxical, immanent and transcendent, infinite and anthropomorphic, male and female. At once omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, and omnibenevolent, and yet reachable, personal, loving, caring, creating, forgiving, and intervening. Embraceable, and yet in and through all things. A supreme being, and yet a divine union. Central, and yet the balance of extremes. A divinity beyond finite comprehension, but knowable and accessible in the person of Jesus Christ, the author and finisher of salvation, and of the promise that, though we see now through a glass darkly, we shall yet see as we are seen. On the strength of this promise, we may suppose that we will come in due course to know the truth about the Heavenly Mother. Thank you.
Whenever I teach a class in Greek and Roman mythology, I always begin with a warning to my students that the subject matter of the course is definitely R-rated. And could even be X-rated if I did not edit the material somewhat. For myths almost always deal with sex and violence. As Paul has already indicated in his introduction, the approach we are taking today is a mythological one. The society or individual who values myth sees it as sacred history and recognizes that the complexity of the universe is such that the greatest truths cannot be stated as simple factual propositions, but must be couched in symbolic language with multiple facets, ambiguities, and various levels of interpretation. One school of myth interpretation, Levi Strauss's structural approach, asserts that the very nature of the universe is paradoxical, full of contradictions, and that the purpose of myth is to bring about a resolution to these contradictions, to act as a mediation between two polar extremes. And this leads me to my theme, the connection between myth and sex. If Levi Strauss is correct in assuming that mythical thought always progresses from the awareness of opposition toward its resolution, then it is no wonder that the sexes and the struggle between them occupy such a large proportion of the mythic narratives. The idea of dividing the world into polar opposites is both ancient and universal. And opposites with the universal male and female principles is also a widespread notion. On a symbolic level, for example, the male and female are represented by objects which are extensions of their sexual characteristics. The female is the womb, the universal container, the vessel, the cup, the well, the scabbard, the temple, the cave, the earth itself which receives, holds, and gives birth to all. In contrast, the male principle is represented by phallic symbols, the rod, the scepter, the staff, the sword, the plow, the sickle, the tree, as well as all that comes from heaven, rain, lightning, thunder, etc. In ancient mythologies, the sky god is usually a male, and of course his counterpart is the fertile earth goddess. On a more abstract level, male and female are associated with other dualities, substance form, spirit body, truth light, day night, justice mercy, symbolic literal, history myth, conscious subconscious, secular sacral, rational intuitive, square compass, linear, circular, individual, community, freedom, obedience, culture, nature, state, church, above, below, active, passive. The list can go on and on. Listing pairs of opposites is really quite simple. More difficult is deciding which of each pair should be linked with the female principle and which with the male. Traditionally, and I use that term not so much to mean Western tradition, but to refer to Jungian archetypal patterns, certain pairs have been clearly linked with one sex or the other. For example, spirit is usually connected with the male and body with the female, day with the male and night with the female, justice with the male, mercy with the female, the rational with the male, the intuitive with the female, active with the male and passive with the female. Other pairs are more difficult to align. For example, culture and nature, symbolic and literal, history and myth. Is nature feminine, as suggested by the term Mother Nature, or is it masculine, as suggested by the popular belief that men go off adventuring into nature while women keep the home fires burning? Even those pairs that are traditionally linked with one sex or the other are sometimes turned around, not just by moderns who want to erase sexual stereotypes, but by more ancient thinkers like Philo, the first century Hellenistic Jewish philosopher and theologian, who wrote of the twofold nature of God manifest as the masculine and feminine principles. God as Father is begetter, creator, and reason. God as Mother is bearer, nurturer, and practical wisdom. All this we could predict. What is surprising is that Philo assigns soft qualities such as gentleness, beneficence, and goodness to the Father side of God, and hard qualities such as the legislative, chastising, and corrective powers to the Mother. Philo believed that since it is the Mother who maintains order, it is she who must reprove. So it is not clear what particular qualities, principles, or characteristics should be attributed to a given sex, and it never has been clear. Moreover, most attempts at creating clear delineations of male and female are simplistic, rigid, moralistic, and short-lived. This is true in our own Mormon culture, where for years there has predominated the black and white assertion that males are masculine men and females are feminine women. This view, it is only fair to point out, no longer obtains, even in our official literature, where there is the willingness now to admit that there are certain ambiguities in male and female roles. In a current Relief Society lesson, for example, a mother education lesson, women are encouraged to obtain as much schooling as they wish and to excel in all their pursuits. Moreover, women are also told to seek a career, both for their personal fulfillment as well as for the support of their families if the need arises. And mothers are advised to help both their sons and daughters to develop certain characteristics such as faith in God, compassion for others, respect for themselves and each other. Now it is also acceptable for boys to learn homemaking skills and for girls to enjoy sports. In spite of this modest improvement, however, the overall tone of this lesson is condescending and patronizing. And when it comes to the relationship between men and women, the old truisms are reasserted as women are told that the man is to preside, provide, and protect through his role as wage earner and priesthood holder, while the woman is to support, sustain, and strengthen through her role as homemaker and mother. The lesson quotes Elder Boy K. Packer to this effect. Quote, he, your husband, needs to know that he is protecting you. He needs to feel that he is the leader in the family. He needs to feel dominant. End quote. The implication is that if women try to undermine men in their superior position by harboring negative feelings about their role as homemakers, they will upset the divine plan ordained by God and thereby help the adversary in destroying the family. As I read this lesson, I feel a good deal of inner conflict. On the one hand, I believe that sexuality is an eternal reality, that the image of God is reflected in both the male and the female, and that certain sexual differences are eternal. In fact, it is the very differences that create the need for bonding. The lesson contains a good statement by President Kimball along these lines. The bodies of men and the bodies of women were created differently so they complemented each other, so that the union of the two would bring conception, which would bring a living soul into the world. And from my own point of view, I see this whole creative process as symbolic of a deeper metaphysical truth. Sexual love is the most universal form of man's obscure search to eliminate duality for a short while, to existentially overcome the boundary between ego and not ego, between self and not self. Flesh and sex are the tools for an ecstatic approximation of achievement of unity. That's a quote from Metaphysics of Sex. But though I see the significance of the differences between men and women, I, on the other hand, am offended by the way these differences are translated into societal roles, many of which are artificial, contrived, simple-minded, and rigid, and which contradict my own feelings and experiences. So here I am faced with a dilemma.
How can I reconcile my abstract belief that there exist God-ordained differences between men and women with the concrete reality of so many superficial male and female sex roles that are being thrust upon me? Remember that I began this paper with Levi Strauss's statement that the purpose of myth is to resolve contradictions. I have come to accept the validity of this statement because in my study of myth, I have found ways of resolving some of these conflicts I have felt. From the ancient myths, there emerged a picture of the world as a place divided into universal male and female principles. This world, however, is neither simplistic nor rigid, and understanding it is not easy for people steeped in or seduced by the modern secular worldview. For this reason, what I propose to do in the remainder of this paper is to list and discuss several guidelines that I have found useful in understanding the relationship of male and female from a mythological perspective. Then I will apply these principles to two myths that deal very specifically with male and female sex roles. The first of these interpretive guidelines is succinctly stated in the Book of Mormon as a paradox. There must needs be opposition in all things, and yet all things must needs be a compound in one. This is a powerful idea. It suggests that there exist necessary opposites. It also suggests that each pair of necessary opposites form a compound in one. Moreover, it is implied that each member of such a pair contains in itself the characteristics of the opposite member. It is the sameness in each opposite that makes possible the union of the two into a single compound. Thus, male and female are both necessary opposites created to be united into one, with each sex containing in it some characteristics of the other, which makes the bonding possible. Hence, though it is undoubtedly true that opposites attract, there is equal validity in the view that like seeks like, and in the language of the Doctrine and Covenants, intelligence cleaveth unto intelligence, wisdom receiveth wisdom, truth embraceth truth. Even the sexual organs of the body, which some feel are the only real difference between men and women, contain patterns of the opposing sex. The testicles are vessels, analogous to the breasts. There is a correspondence between milk and semen, both life-giving substances. This correspondence applies to other male and female patterns and symbols. A tree, for example, may be viewed as a phallic symbol, but it is comprised of both male and female parts, the stem and the foliage. The whole seems always to be a compound comprised of male and female components, each of which seems in its own right to be a compound of the male and female, and therefore a reflection of the whole. The same principle applies on an abstract level. Take the notion of the feminine passive and the masculine active. Gandhi understood that within the female could be found a male component. Thus, he was able to use masculine aspects of passivity to actively oppose the injustice of a powerful oppressor, and the weapon of passive resistance was born. A second guideline is to distinguish between necessary opposites and rival opposites. I have noticed that in our culture, when people are dealing consciously or unconsciously with necessary opposites, they tend to prefer one opposite over the other. For example, most Westerners would prefer to be thought of as active and aggressive. No one wants to be thought of as passive. It's seen as a weakness, aggressiveness as strength, as an essential prerequisite to accomplishing anything significant. This is what we tell our sons and now our daughters. In my view, however, that passive and the active principles are of equal value. Last summer, this view was reinforced when I broke my left hand. At first, I did not think this would greatly inconvenience me since I am right-handed. I soon rediscovered the importance of the passive role of the hand that holds things still so that the active hand can do its work. Try peeling a potato with one hand or slicing a loaf of bread. I also became aware of how many tasks require the use of both hands functioning in unison. Try putting on a pair of pantyhose with one hand when you're pregnant. It is as impossible as it is hilarious, and my husband has suggested that we market my technique as a party game. Opposites consist of two members, one of which is the perversion or distortion of the other. A devil is the opposite of a god, but not in the same way that a goddess is the opposite of a god. God and goddess are extremes on the same continuum that must be brought into union. The devil is the opposite of God in the way sour milk is the opposite of good milk, to use C.S. Lewis's analogy. The devil is a fallen god. Moreover, the devil can also include a female counterpart, an idea born out in Jewish legend, where there exists a strong tradition dealing with Adam's fallen wife, Lilith, who becomes a female demon. But even rival opposites take upon themselves a paradoxical dimension when we think of the benefits which often flow from the negative member of the pair. Pain and suffering can build character, sickness may promote an appreciation of health, and death can often be a welcome blessing. Moreover, the good member of the pair may inadvertently promote evil. Seekers of pleasure often find emptiness and pain. He who seeks his life will lose it, while he who loses his life may find it. There is also a further paradox. In eliminating evil, God will not employ evil means. Rather than destroy Satan and become himself a destroyer, God sacrifices himself in love, in recognition of the principle that in dealing as our enemy, we risk becoming like our enemy. I point all this out to give you a taste of the complexity involved in the interplay between necessary and rival opposites. Another guideline to understanding the mythic relation of the sexes is to avoid our own cultural biases, or at least to understand how they color our outlook. To do this, we must expose ourselves to other cultures near and far, ancient and modern. This will help us to detect our own prejudices and blind spots, and in particular to avoid the presumption that our own sex roles and stereotypes are universal, when in fact they are only parochial. I have noticed that many of my students, male and female, are, upon reading the Odyssey, taken aback by the hero Odysseus's public, unconsolable, and tearful lamentation over his losses. This happens because they assume that the modern masculine aversion to public displays of sentiment is a universal male characteristic. Rather than question their own prejudice on this point, most students conclude that Odysseus was not such a great hero after all. The guidelines I have discussed so far compel us to face a rather complex picture. This recognition brings me to the next guideline, namely that oversimplification usually distorts the mythic picture. One common method of oversimplification is to confuse the subject with the object. In other words, we confuse a given sex with what it seeks. The male seeks the female for what he lacks, and the female seeks the male for what she lacks. But we can confuse the thing sought or possessed with the one seeking or possessing. How can we know the dancer from the dance? Let me illustrate this. Though structure is a feminine principle and matriarchal cultures tend to be sedentary and full of buildings and monuments, we find that males often dominate such societies. This occurs because the male seeks a feminine social order. On the other hand, in heroic patriarchal cultures, we often find dominant women, Lady Macbeth, Medea, Clytemnestra, etc. This happens because women do not thrive in a feminine social order, but in a masculine one where on the basis of their personal character and strengths, they are accorded positions of equality and even power. In our own Mormon culture, the heavily bureaucratized church, a feminine structure, is controlled by a hierarchy of men content with their imperial priesthood offices. Here, too, the male seeks the feminine structure. Meanwhile, the female, who in such a structure is apt to suffer from a lack of inner life and meaning, seeks a looser, more masculine ecclesiastical arrangement where individuals are valued for their own personal gifts rather than for their acknowledged status in a fixed system. A more obvious method of oversimplification is our predilection for quick and easy moralizing. When I taught primary a few years ago, I noticed how ill-suited to moralizing the scriptures really are. Bible stories are seldom reducible to morals: don't steal, don't cheat, don't lie. What is the moral of the story of Rahab the prostitute, or Abraham in Egypt, or Daniel? Our desire for quick and easy morals is connected with our obsession with the pragmatic. We tend to distrust any idea that cannot be directly applied to our lives, preferably with immediate and verifiable results. Since myths deal more with the metaphysical than the practical, they usually strike modern men and women as obscure, irrelevant, or nonsensical. At best, they are entertaining. We have largely lost the ability to respond to the world in a religious way. We see ourselves as both subject and agent, to quote Mircea Eliade. Since secular man cannot recognize transcendent forces, he looks for all meaning in the here and now, as he creates it, rather than recognizing how his own existence fits in with the larger mystical patterns of creation. Eliade sees this as the primary distinction between the non-religious secular man and the religious sacral man. Where the secular man sees in the world only forces which can be utilized and applied to improve his present situation, the sacral man sees in his present situation symbols which can connect him with universal transcendent forces. I am not arguing that the secular approach is evil and the sacral is good. In fact, I see these two principles as yet another example of necessary opposites that must be balanced. In our modern world, however, the secular worldview is so strong and such a part of our way of thinking that we cannot readily recognize its limitations or acknowledge any co-valid paradigms for viewing the universe. Church members are inheritors of this secular worldview along with the rest of Western civilization and inevitably transfer their thinking to their religious views. Thus, Mormons tend to see the scriptures not as symbols to awaken us to metaphysical comprehension of the world, but as lessons for daily living. We seldom recognize that the most important gospel principles, the resurrection, the redemption, the judgment, cannot be directly applied to our daily life, except by faith, by believing that these are the realities that shape the cosmos in which we live. It is difficult for Mormons to simply let principles work in their hearts and minds. We are forever seeking to do something visible, something we can report to our leaders and set down in our correlated reports. This reminds me of the talk given by a high councilman. Of course, there are practical lessons in scripture and myth, but if these are not seen in their theological and mythical context, they will inevitably yield a distorted picture of reality. This reminds me of the talk given by a high councilman to some young people. He told them the story of David and Bathsheba. His purpose was to show what would happen to a man who had a pornography problem. Is the naked human body obscene? Is a young man's desire to see a woman's naked body perverse? The result of oversimplification is, ultimately, religious superficiality. This reminds me of an acquaintance for whom the whole meaning of the temple, as it relates to men and women, reduces to a single prescription of priesthood authority. For him, it means that if he and his wife disagree about the color of the vinyl, he gets to have the last say. Is this what it means for a woman to obey her husband in righteousness as he obeys the Lord? What these reminiscences illustrate is the process of profanation, whereby the significant is made trivial and the sacred is made profane. This is the opposite of sacralization, whereby the common is exalted and the imminent made profound. But even the process of profanation is paradoxical, and in some instances can itself be sacred. For example, Christ subjected himself to the profane that the profane could be made divine. And this observation leads me to my last interpretive guideline. The picture of male and female archetypal patterns is complicated by the fact that sexes can and sometimes must undergo role reversals. The male does and sometimes must become the female, and the female does and sometimes must become the male. Unless this happens, a rigidity will result that will effectively stifle creativity and life. Role reversals occur in many guises. Parent becomes child, and child becomes parent. Teacher becomes student, and student becomes teacher. Host becomes guest, and guest becomes host. Beggar becomes king, and king becomes beggar. Haven't you noticed these in your own life? Becoming a parent makes you a more sympathetic child, while remaining a child tends to make you a more sympathetic parent. Teachers, by becoming students again, become better teachers, while students becoming teachers become better students. And the king, who has never been a beggar, will often harden into a tyrant. So we find the ubiquitous motif of the good king who has gone in disguise as a beggar among his people, Odysseus, Henry V, and of course Christ himself. With the man and the woman, the role reversal is equally important. It is only through such a turnabout that a proper balance can be maintained between the sexes. By switching roles, each sex has a basis on which to comprehend and sympathize with the other, to begin to see the world from the other's point of view. In the writings of Jeremiah, there is a passage of scripture that hints at this process. For the Lord hath created a new thing in the earth, a woman shall compass a man. The Hebrew word here used for compass is sabab. It means to revolve, surround, be about on every side, whirl around, to turn oneself about, to lead. The New English Bible renders this passage as follows. The Lord has created a new thing in the earth, a woman turned into a man. So the woman can take the man's role. She can lead and encompass or include him, a reversal of St. Paul's statement that woman was made out of man. On the other hand, men are also asked to take the female role of nurturing. In Numbers 11, Moses, troubled with the burdensome task of caring for the children of Israel, asked the Lord, "Am I their mother? Have I brought them into the world? And am I called upon to carry them in my bosom like a nurse with her babies?" The Lord's answer to this question is yes, but he tells Moses that he won't have to bear this burden alone. And this is why Moses assembles the 70 elders. Now, I have discussed five guidelines for interpreting sex roles in myth and scripture. To reiterate, they are, first, all things are a compound in one, and there must needs be opposition in all things. Thus, both man and woman are necessary, and each is made up of feminine and masculine characteristics. Second, there is a distinction between necessary opposites and rival opposites. Third, cultural biases can bind us to truth. Fourth, oversimplification often leads to a distortion of reality. And finally, fifth, role reversals are necessary to keep proper balance between necessary opposites, particularly the male and the female. With these ideas in mind, I would now like to discuss sexual role reversals in two myths, the story of Abraham and Sarah and the story of Adam and Eve. I refer to these stories as myths not because I think they are untrue, but because I wish to emphasize their symbolic importance as patterns for us to imitate. I am one who takes these stories quite literally, but I see them as myth because their importance does not rest upon the accuracy of the incidents that make up the story, but rather on how and why the story is told. Myth can be historical, and history can be mythical. All things are a compound in one. Isaiah puts the story of Abraham and Sarah in this context of myth or religious paradigm. Listen to me, all who follow the right and seek the Lord. Look to the rock from whence you were hewn, to the quarry from which you were dug. Look to your father Abraham and to Sarah who gave you birth. Abraham is the rock and Sarah is the quarry. Both are models for us. And what is the pattern that emerges? First, we see that God not only makes a covenant with Abraham, but he makes a covenant with Sarah as well. Though the inheritance of Sarah and Abraham is intertwined, still Sarah receives a blessing of her own, a blessing that is not simply tacked on to Abraham's. After Abram is given the new name of Abraham, the Lord says, "As for Sarai, thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. And I will bless her and give thee a son also of her. Yea, I will bless her, and she will be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her." So Sarah is given a blessing identical with Abraham's and a new name to signify her change in status before God. She is to stand as a queen or princess in her own right, independent in the sphere in which God has placed her. She is to be Sarah, meaning a princess of peace. The priesthood would continue in her as well as in Abraham. When Abraham hears that Sarah will be a mother, his response is incredulous laughter. Then he says to the Lord, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." In other words, Abraham is asking why the Lord does not simply fulfill his promise of making Abraham a father of multitudes through Ishmael. Wouldn't that be easier? Yes, but that is not what he intends to do. The Lord says that though he will remember Ishmael and make him great, it is going to be through Sarah that the covenant is to be established. This is an important part of the story. The Lord had promises to keep with Sarah as well as with Abraham. Out of love for Abraham, Sarah had been willing to sacrifice by giving him her handmaid Hagar so that Abraham could have posterity and increase. Now the Lord remembers Sarah's sacrifice and gives her increase by opening her womb himself. Thus it is the Lord who plays the most important part in the story. The fulfillment of his promise to Abraham and Sarah comes by the power of God. Isaac was born by a miracle. That which is born from below remains below. That which is born from above can ascend on high. Isaac came through the covenant of Jesus Christ. And since God worked his miracle on Sarah, she, as Paul observed, represents Jerusalem, who is above, which is the mother of us all. Both Abraham and Sarah are sealed to the Lord through covenant. The sign of Sarah's sealing is Isaac, the child of promise. The sign of Abraham's sealing is the circumcision. Here we have another reversal. In giving birth to Isaac, Sarah bled at the genitals. In circumcision, Abraham also bled at the genitals, symbolizing his covenant or marriage to God. In many tribes, circumcision is linked with premarital rites, and in some tribes, boys even wear girls' clothing when they are circumcised. So Abraham and Sarah both play the role of woman before God. And in turn, both Abraham and Sarah play the part of priest. For though at times she looks to him for salvation, at other times he looks to her. There is an apocryphal story that takes place before Abraham and Sarah make their sojourn into Egypt. Abraham has a dream in which he sees a pine tree that would have been chopped down and used for firewood if it had not been for a palm tree that in some way spared its life. Abraham is told that he is the pine tree and Sarah the palm. It would be because of Sarah that his life would be spared. This came to pass when the Pharaoh gave honor to Abraham as the sister of Sarah, the Pharaoh's intended spouse. For Abraham, at the command of God, had disclosed to Pharaoh only his relationship as sister. Though Abraham was spared by this device, Sarah was put to the test. Her virtue was placed on the line, rather I should say on the lion couch, the sacrificial bed. She was willing to give up her virtue to save her husband's life. Her sacrifice, like her husband's, was an arrested one. For every time the Pharaoh approached her sexually, he was warded off by a disease. Eventually, he learned the truth, and after chastising Abraham for the whole scheme, he counted himself lucky not to have angered their God and let them both go. Sarah, by her sacrifice, not only saved Abraham, but provided us with a symbol of the truth that both the male and the female may serve as priest. Both may be called to make sacrifice which is the chief priestly function. Both have power to confer life on the other. Both play a role in salvation. The story of Adam and Eve also illustrates the principle of role reversals. Though it is Adam who must lead Eve from the temporal sphere back into the eternal, it is given to Eve to lead Adam into the temporal sphere in the first place. It is she who recognizes the necessity of partaking of the forbidden fruit. She perceives that it is only by experiencing both good and evil that they can indeed become like God. Her only mistake is that she takes Satan for a messenger of God, supposing that he has been sent to lead them into further light and knowledge. Throughout the story, it is Eve who takes the initiative and is the first on the scene, as Hugh Nibley points out. While Adam sleeps, Eve is there waiting for him, and upon awakening, the first person Adam sees is Eve, and therefore rightly assumes that she must be the source of all that he sees, the mother of all living. Eve is the first to understand that they cannot stay in their paradise forever and enjoy any increase. It is she who realizes the necessity of remaining together. Thus, she uses this argument to persuade Adam to follow her into mortality. She is the first to recognize the true identity of Satan. It is she who quickly comprehends the necessity of opposition to bring about eternal life and joy. And finally, it is her seed who will crush the serpent's head. We have no passive, retiring woman in Mother Eve. If anyone, it is Adam who takes the passive role in the Garden of Eden. This is hard for us to perceive because of our cultural biases. Even our modern version of the temple ceremony obscures this, particularly the film version, where Adam is portrayed as a sweet, cowering wife who always remains a little behind Adam. The life ceremony is much better in portraying the relationship between Adam and Eve. One of the problems with the film is that it is set in concrete. The celluloid freezes in place symbols that should be ever fluid and subject to reinterpretation through the ritual drama, so that the richness of the varying nuances can be observed. Eve pays a price for bringing about the fall. God tells her that her desire shall be to her husband, and he shall rule over her. Is this her punishment for taking the initiative, for usurping Adam's place? No, rather it is the way God has of restoring the balance between the two sexes created as a result of the fall. In the eternal realm, it is Eve who initiates the temporal, while Adam yields to her work. In the temporal sphere, it is Adam who initiates the spiritual, while Eve yields to his work. From the heavenly perspective, sometimes the woman is on top and sometimes the man, and at other times they repose in perfect harmony. The exchange of roles prevents either sex from dominating or eliminating its complementary and necessary opposite. But all things are a compound in one. Though Eve is to obey Adam, he is not given absolute authority over her. The phrase, in righteousness as he obeys the Lord, is the check on Adam's power. He is not to have the last say in everything. Rather, in matters of righteousness, that is, in the gospel of Christ, by which righteousness is imputed to fall on man, he is to initiate and she is to bring to fruition. Nibley observes, there is no patriarch or matriarchy in the garden. The two supervise each other. Adam is given no arbitrary power. Eve is to heed him only insofar as he obeys their father. And who decides that? She must keep check on him as much as he does on her. Always there are the paradoxes. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. She was first in the garden, he followed. Now he is first, and she follows. And then it will switch back again. So is it really better to be first? Jesus saved the good wine until last. And at the last comes the healing of the wounds. It was Mary who performed the last ordinances to prepare Jesus for the resurrection. And she with the other women were the last ones at the foot of the cross, witnessing the death of their God. But these same women were the first witnesses of the resurrection. And while the apostles were the first called to preach the gospel, they were the last of the chosen to witness its fruits. This shifting of roles, this exchange of natures, this interplay between opposites is the very stuff of life. The cup of one must empty that the cup of the other may be filled, that both may pour out their abundance to receive an even greater fullness. It is not in the elimination of extremes that life comes forth, but in their balance, where contraries come into accord. And the sex act itself, with its fluctuations and alterations of below and above, full and empty, hard and soft, in and out, union and division, is the perfect symbol of this dynamic marriage of necessary opposites that liberates the creative forces that are in this world the source of new life, and in the next world the source of eternal life, spinning and moving and living from eternity to eternity. And those who behold this fearful symmetry may with John Donne sing, "My face in thine eye, thine in mine appears, and true plain hearts do in the faces rest. Where can we find two better hemispheres without sharp north, without declining west? Whatever dies was not mixed equally. If our two loves be one, or thou and I love so alike that none do slacken, none can die."
My great-grandmother, Alice Merrill Horn, was described by Leonard Arrington as the greatest cultural one of the great cultural entrepreneurs of Western America. She was a promoter of art in the state of Utah. She was a legislator. She organized sit-down demonstrations to protect monuments like the Eagle Gate that people wanted to knock down. She organized a milk program to see that every child could have milk to drink, and she promoted smokeless fuel so that the valley would not be gray. Very powerful, wonderful lady, granddaughter of Bathsheba Smith. She was in the temple one day during the Adam and Eve ceremony, and Adam turned to God and he said that the reason he partook of the fruit was that this woman had him do it, and you gave me this woman. Whereupon Alice Merrill Horn stood up, glared at him, and hissed, "Coward." That may let you know a little bit about my genetic predisposition on this topic. One of the things I think we need to do, and one of the things I have liked very much about the Sunstone Conference, was watching us take a giant step. Imagine hearing three fine Mormon scholars defend Joseph as a practicer of white magic. I like that. I like very much the energy and the vitality by which an obviously bright man, not a wimp, is willing to discuss an equal goddess. That is excellent for me. I love pulling 100 books out and starting to read. I learn from that. I love discussing the myth of Eve and Sarah because I will have a different interpretation, and that's what's wonderful about myth. It is read in many different ways depending on your own personal experience. So that I know what we believe here, I'd like to ask a question that has nothing to do with your eternal progression. I'd like to know how many of you remember dreams you have. This is wonderful. How many of you write them down? How many of you go back and read them and analyze later? Troops, we have work to do. Jung, we are tossing around very casually at this conference on the archetype. That is a very powerful philosophical and psychological symbol. I think we're trivializing it to some extent. I don't want to lecture on it, but Jung puts the archetype in the unconscious and in the collective unconscious. The archetype is to the psyche what instinct is to your biology. It is a pattern. It is a form. It is, as Plato would say, an idea, the hoarseness of being a horse. It will give you an unconscious response even if you're not aware of it. The reason this is important is because male and female created he them, we all have male and female within us. And if, as men, we are not familiar with our female side, which we will be through our dreams, or if, as women, we are not familiar with our male side, we will ourselves be out of balance, as will our perceptions. So that is an important thing. The next thing on the goddess is to understand that there are times in the culture of the world where the goddess has been the creator. Goddesses are not always earth mothers. I always think of Elizabeth Taylor as an earth mother, so I'm trying to get away from that. Maybe Joan Rivers would be a good earth mother. But anyway, the thing that's nice about a goddess is that there are air goddesses. The Tibetans have the Tara, the white goddess. The Isis is an air goddess. You have goddesses that are associated with the moon. Men think being the sun is wonderful. In hot climates, the sun burns the little plants. It is the moon that is fertile, that allows regeneration. And female goddesses ally with the moon, with the dark side, which is equally powerful and creative. So there is a history of a female goddess. Female goddesses are often virgins. That does not mean that they are without sexual experience. Many of them have a lot of sexual experience, and they enjoy it a great deal. And they are mothers, but they are not wives. They are the virgin in one, the woman standing alone, the goddess. She is not a reflection of the male or the female Zeus. She is a goddess. That's an important concept that we'll get to when we deal with Hera. Okay, that's enough on the symbolism. I'd like to kind of move on into Eve, get back to the coward image. The thing that I find interesting about Eve is that she was able to follow a higher law, and she operated on her own experience. I think she's gotten a bad rap. I do not think that Eve did something bad. I think it is the place of the female to lead in birth. I look at the Garden of Eden as a womb, of course. It is only sensible that the female would be the dynamic principle in producing the birth of the human being from the womb, which is a halfway house between the heavens and the earth, and lead humanity there. She should be the active principle. If she were not, then we could get after her. I see nothing wrong with Adam being the left hand, the passive principle. Let him be passive. I see Eve as introducing death to this earth. The goddess like Persephone, the goddess of Hades, has a death aspect. If Eve led us into a temporal life where we got death, we would also get rebirth. Death is a transformation, a regeneration. It is not an end. And when you come out as something different. That is a fine thing to bring in. But if Eve brought death, who brought life? Christ. If she brought the death, Christ brought the resurrection. That balance was fulfilled. For that reason, I take strong disagreement with the idea that the females of this earth from the Garden of Eden on are second-rate spiritual beings that have to depend upon a man to lead them back to their spiritual home. If we are dependent upon men to get us there, we are in serious trouble. I think that Eve's balance was redressed. I do not look upon the fact that women do not hold the priesthood as an answer to the problem of Eve biting the apple. I think that is a rationalization, just like saying that the reason the blacks can't hold the priesthood is because they were fence sitters in the pre-existence. That I do not identify with. I do identify with Nibley on his system of checks and balances. That reads to me. You do balance each other off. Let me deal with Boyd Packer, because that is an opportunity I have looked forward to. He needs to know that he is protecting you. He needs to feel that he is the leader in the family. He needs to feel dominant. Now, I am a football fan. When somebody tells me dominate, I think of Al Davis and the L.A. Raiders. They are really the Oakland Raiders, so I will call them that. I see those massive black and gray guys come out, the mafia of the football teams. They come out with their, you know, their arms are wrapped, their drugs are high, they're going to blast, they're going to knock, they're going to grind. That's a wonderful image. Davis says, just win, baby. All right. Now, if I want to be protected, I want the front four of the Los Angeles Raiders in front of me. I am the quarterback. Those guys are going to go out and they are going to dominate the hell, not out of me, but out of the other team. If a man is going to protect his family, he is not going to do it by dominating the woman. He is going to go out and dominate the rest of the people so that his family is safe. I said to my husband last night, I said, do you feel like I can be your front four? He said, yes, please. Bob is my front four. He moves down the field for me so that if I need to pass or run or hand off, I can do that. I try and do that for him. Male and female protect each other. Women, you protect your better than they do. They'll never figure it out, but you know what you do for them. Men, you know how much you rely on your women and how you do want to keep them safe. That is fine. You do not protect a soul of God by dominating that person. Now, I would like Brother Packer to read the Doctrine and Covenants. I copied it all down. I don't need to recite it to you. You know it. But think of how they said the priesthood should be held. With kindness, with gentleness, with meekness, with love unfeigned. Do those sound like dominate? They talk about the danger of a power exercised unrighteously, the danger of a little power that leads you to grind somebody. That does not enter into a male-female relationship that is in any sense a mature relationship. So I think that Brother Packer should consider the team quality rather than the feudal quality. A medieval image of the Lord of the Manor does not work in today's society. We take a basketball team, a football team. Does Magic Johnson knock Kareem Abdul-Jabbar out of bounds? Or tell him where to stand to shoot the ball? Does that wonderful Japanese volleyball team, the females in the Olympics, they move as a body? So remember what Paul said. Is the eye more important than the foot? Is the head more important than the heart? Is the hand more important than the liver? You are a unit. That's all I want to say about dominance, but thank you for the opportunity. The next thing I want to deal with is Hera. I very much enjoyed Paul's paper. I treat it, though, as a pillar of my faith speech rather than as an intellectual or analyzed topic. His description of historians would send anyone that has been in a historiography seminar into permanent oblivion. We are not cause and effect. We are not linear. In fact, no historian will agree on any other historian's methodology. So you need to not label somebody and then knock them down. It is not good to refer to the Jews as their primary contribution being silly monotheism. Now they're calling us silly pantheists in Israel. We got to get rid of this. I think that if you're going to consider a female god, it is difficult for me to follow the logic of saying myth is all-encompassing, which it is. Ritual is a reflection or an active principle of a myth. Marriage is a ritual. Therefore, God is married, so Jesus was married, or Jesus got married to show us God was married. I stop here. I do not know if God is married. I do know that there is a female goddess. I do not know in what form. Stop and look at the different forms that goddesses have in the history of this world. Hera is the wife form. They said the Greeks feared her and hated her. She was jealous. She was mean. She was difficult. She viewed sex purely for procreation, never for enjoyment. Then you have Aphrodite, lovely, accessible, easy to deal with. You have the Buddhist goddesses. You have Terra in the sky. You have the Dakinis. Active, vibrant principles. You have in China, Kuan Yin, my favorite. I have her in my dining room. Kuan Yin achieved enlightenment, and when the time came to step across the line, which for better symbol I'll say celestial kingdom, it doesn't work, but then we understand. She said, no, I will not take a personal reward until I can bring all of humanity with me. She became a bodhisattva, which is a person who lives to bless the human race until they are all ready for enlightenment. She is known as the one who hears the weeping of the world. Powerful female goddess, the Christ figure. Now, which one of these is our goddess? Is our goddess a young girl? A lovely, attractive person? Is our goddess a wife, a mirror? Is our goddess an independent, a virgin? Is our goddess a person alone or a person in harmony? There are so many ways to look at her that I feel very constrained to say she is the wife and the mother of us all. I get my daughter said, well, of course, mother, I mean, who's going to have Jesus and Satan? And I picture the celestial kingdom as enormous labor and delivery room. That is very difficult as an image. So on the Sarah. I liked reading that, but I read the Bible, and twice Sarah pretended to be Abraham's sister so that she could save his life. I think that the saving of his life was indeed a priestly function, an act for which he did also. I do not see that losing your virtue is the equivalent of killing Isaac, especially depending on what kind of a goddess Sarah was. Because if the Pharaoh looked like, what's the one with no hair? Yul Brynner? That's potential for, you know, something pleasant. I am not one to say that for a goddess, especially if she views herself as a virgin with sexual experience, that having to have a sexual experience to save your husband's life and found a particular race for God, that's a sacrifice. But I fail to see it on the cosmic level of the death of Isaac with the Savior. That just doesn't ring to me. It may ring to others. That is fine. I don't particularly personally identify with that. I feel that one of the things that we have to be careful with in Jung, and the reason I asked you about his, about your recording your dreams, is that Jung says, Christians often ask why God does not speak to them, as he is believed to have done in former days. When I hear such questions, it always makes me think of the rabbi who was asked how it could be that God often showed himself in the olden days, but nobody ever sees him anymore. The rabbi replied, nowadays there is no longer anybody who can bow low enough. I like that. I like that because I have heard the condescending tone of people saying Joseph had a divining rod. He was not educated. He did not wear a three-piece suit. How can this man talk to God? How do any of us talk to God? I think we ought to find that out. Jung says that we are so captivated and so entangled with our consciousness that we do not tap into the unconscious, to the archetypes within us, to the ability within us to communicate instinctively with our world. And that until we bring our own personal being into harmony, we will not understand the myths, we will not understand the archetypes, because we're doing it with only one side of us. And we will not have the experiences that grounded folks have. So I enjoyed this because it gave me the opportunity to see that there is a lot of work for me, as for others, in developing a personal experience so that we can evaluate others' experiences, in developing a vocabulary so we can speak about God without using the he pronoun, in developing a way of looking at myths in many directions. I'd like to spend a whole session on the serpent in the garden. Serpents alone are powerful in dreams. I appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
We've got a few minutes to have you field some questions to our people here. If you would stand, say it loudly, and then field your question to an individual if you have that in mind. And then would you repeat the question so that the question will end up on the tape, because this session is being taped. Yes.
She asked about the section in my paper where I talk about structure being a feminine principle, and therefore, because structure is a feminine principle, the church itself, the hierarchy, the structure of that would be a feminine principle. And she wanted me to elaborate on that idea. This, admittedly, is a very complex idea. The idea that you can have, when you're talking about male and female archetypes, very abstract things like this. And it is true that the female does usually represent order, structure, the body itself, you see, which is often represented as the female principle, is the container. It really goes back to the idea of the female as container. It's that which gives order or structure or contains or holds and so forth. So the idea of structure being feminine comes really out of that symbol. Now, the idea that I was trying to develop there is that sometimes we confuse the male and female components of things, because we look at the thing that somebody is seeking rather than the thing itself. We can, what I said in the paper, we confuse the object with the subject, or the thing sought with the one seeking it. And from my own point of view, the idea is that since feminine is a female principle, that then it's often the male who seeks that, and therefore he's the one that will sometimes predominate in a culture that is matriarchal in nature, that has this sort of very structured quality to it. And the opposite is true. My definition of matriarchal and patriarchal cultures there comes from an article that Nibley did, where he talks about matriarchal cultures being sedentary and agricultural and so forth, and male cultures being the sort of hunter culture, the explorer, the wanderer, and all of this. But understand that all of those are just their patterns. And one of the ideas I'm trying to express in the paper is that when you take these very complex patterns, mythic patterns, and try to in a very simplistic manner apply them on a sort of a practical level, they always get very distorted and lead to all sorts of perversions, I think. Because it's a complex picture. It's not a one-to-one relationship that we want to make it. It's this intertwining, and that's the thing that really makes it rich and yet also difficult sometimes to figure out how it fits.
We're into the lunch hour. I think if you have any questions, maybe you could address the members of the panel individually. We appreciate all of you coming.